Welcome to the Engage and Empower podcast. Behind every successful company is an intentional and innovative approach to empowering your most valuable asset, your people. Join me in having conversations with people and talent leaders as we share our journeys and unpack what it takes to build strong, cohesive teams and employee experiences. From executives at early stage startups to innovators at large public companies, we'll capture the compelling stories of the people behind people teams. Hello, hello, and thanks so much for tuning in to the Engage and Empower podcast. I'm your host, Rasika Rajagopalan, and today I am incredibly thrilled to be chatting with the head of people at Miro, AJ Josephson. AJ has a super cool diversity of experience in the learning and development, as well as people and culture space. Miro is a globally distributed company, and I have definitely used and loved their product, which enables virtual collaboration. So I'm especially excited to pick AJ's brain and learn about what they have been up to. So AJ, it's so great to be chatting with you. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
It's wonderful to be here. Thanks for inviting me. Excited to chat.
Of course. Yes, totally. Your career is, you know, super interesting. You've been all over the map working at large companies and growing startups. And I want to hear all about this, but really quickly, before we dive into that, do you mind giving us the plug on Miro and how big the company is, as well as how large the people team is?
Sure. Miro is lucky to be one of the companies that's really connected to helping people connect and create in whole new ways across the new boundaries that we're all experiencing in the pandemic. And also anyone's experienced if you work in a company that has offices around the world or even on multiple levels of a building. So we're the leading online collaborative whiteboarding platform. And what that is really, it's another surface for interaction. So we have Google Hangouts or Zoom as a video connecting us, but then also we have an online whiteboard to plan together, to put sticky notes on, to input Jira, to have frameworks to discuss, to work on synchronously with teams or asynchronously, commenting on other people's ideas. And alongside text and video, online collaborative whiteboarding has become a key part of how work really happens now. So we are 550, almost 600 people around the world, and we're growing incredibly quickly. I joined a year and a half ago, we're 160, and we're going to be more than doubling again this year. So really in that kind of traditional hypergrowth phase, and lucky to have an incredible team to fuel that journey.
Yeah, totally. And I bet especially now you're seeing that demand really increase and even just like curiosity and awareness around how do we enable distributed work. So exciting time. How large did you say the people team was when you started and what does it look like now?
People team is like 57 people across recruiting, HR, IT and workplace services. So we've got a bit of a wide remit and there's a bunch of recruiters in there because we're growing very, very quickly. You need a lot of recruiting. And when I joined, I think we were in the teens, in the mid-teens, pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's a really solid ratio of people support to your broader organization. So that's great. Well, I would love to hear your story in terms of how you landed in the people and talent space. What kind of brought you here? What guided your journey? What were all the steps along the way?
Yeah, I kind of came into it pretty early. I did my undergraduate degree in medical science, but I really spent all my undergraduate years working for a youth development organization, which did international exchanges and leadership training and running projects. And it's called ISEC and it's in 100 countries around the world. And it kind of was the first time I left Australia. So I grew up in Sydney, never left Australia until I was 18. And then they got me on a plane to Sri Lanka. And suddenly I was meeting people from all over the world and like bits of my mind were taken off the walls because I was mind blown. But changed my worldview, that kind of early experience. And also it kind of taught me a lot about the sense of impact from teaching and leading. And so I got in the water then and I really never looked back. So I spent the next 10 years in nonprofits, in consulting, in finance, a bunch of different kinds of organizations doing like you'd call learning design now or organizational design as well, leading different organizations, designing leadership programs for a bunch of different sectors. And my capstone of that experience was I did my master's degree at Harvard and that brought me to the US. And so it was a great chance to reflect on that period of learning and development in light of some really rigorous theory, do some cool projects with smart people, felt super lucky. And then I moved to Silicon Valley in 2013. So that's kind of my entry point to the world of HR, really through the L&D lens. And then in San Francisco, where I live now, I was in a bunch of companies and took my first really broader HR role in a place called RelateIQ, which is an incredible team in the year 2015. And we were acquired by Salesforce and became SalesforceIQ. And that really exposed me kind of the broadening experience from just kind of seeing L&D and organizational design to seeing the full gamut of the HR system, including all recruiting. And was with them till, I don't know, about 250 people, which seemed huge at the time. And went to Salesforce a little for a couple of years after the acquisition. And then joined Miro a year and a half, 2 years ago at 160.
That's a really cool story. I love your background of coming in from the learning and development space and then using that as a foundation to grow more broadly as a people leader, because I think it's such an invaluable ask to have, since at the end of the day, most of what we do really comes down to enablement. And you've been at such a diversity of organizations, and I think that ramp up period as a new people leader is super challenging in its own way, because I think the things that we're trying to learn about and understand are oftentimes really intangible. And so I'd love to hear more about how you've approached joining new organizations as a new people leader, and generally how that ramp up period has felt for you.
Yeah. When I joined RelateIQ, one of the reasons I joined them, and I encourage anyone who's joining a startup to pick this, is that already built the foundations of an incredible culture. They had a CEO and team who were super invested in modeling that investment in the team, and everyone came along and it felt palpable. At the time, B2C was super hot and cool and engaging when you walked in, but B2B felt flat. And they built that kind of B2C culture in B2B, and one of the first companies to lead that, testament to the CEO, Steve Laughlin, and everyone else who drove that culture. And it was super intimidating to join, to come on board and feel like, whoa, these people, everyone's super psyched. They feel like a team. They all know the values. They all know the mission. They're working together. And I'm the new person. And so you have, in those powerful cultures, you have more of an imposter syndrome. And you always think it's just you. And I, like everyone else, I felt that. And it takes, you know, 3 months minimum to get across that. Some people don't make it out, but everyone goes through it. And so, yeah, when you join those highly engaged cultures, it can be tough at first, especially when you're, you know, they're taking a chance on you because you haven't done it before. If you've done it before, you can come in with a little bit of a different experience and you're kind of more open and you know they want you. And so it can kind of be a bit easier to integrate. For doing that at Miro, I joined at 160. They're a bit further, had a similar engaging, really engaging culture, similar commitment from the whole team, really collaborative, really open, very team first. The difference was it was in a very international context. So that kind of brought me back early days in my career when I'd worked in kind of international youth development of like, oh, great, now I'm surrounded by people from Russia and across Europe. And I'm kind of tickling that intercultural part of my brain and learning about them and tapping into that side of the story. So it was a little bit of a different experience coming in later, but it was really positive in the same way. So we had, I mean, I've seen this myself. I've changed companies, I don't know, 6 times in my career. And every time I think, hey, now I'm experienced, now I'm going to hit the ground running. And every time it's exactly the same. I spend the first 3 months coming home and feeling like I am so tired and I don't know why. I've worked hard on this before. How am I so exhausted? And what I've realized from seeing it myself and seeing it in literally thousands of other people is your brain is doing a lot of subconscious analysis about what's the environment you're in. What's the language people use? Who's cool? How do people push back? What's my role? Who can I be friends with even? How do I say yes or no? Am I on the fast track or the slow track? What are all those behaviors that people are modeling? And it's not intellectual. It's really kind of subconscious, I would say. And so that's a really tiring experience. And you feel like, I don't know, I feel like I'm never going to get out of this. And it really does feel like you're underwater and you're just gasping for air. And then something happens after 3 months and you kind of get above the surface and you're still paddling and struggling, but you're breathing oxygen all the time and it feels okay. And I think that's when your kind of that deep subconscious part of your mind has picked up on those symbols and that culture, gets its environment around you. And I think the next part of it that can sometimes take up to 6 months is figuring out really, how do I apply my strengths in this new context? And often I find new hires feel like, hey, I thought I had all these strengths in my previous role and I've come into this company and they've disappeared. And they haven't disappeared. You just haven't figured out how to apply them in the new context. And then suddenly between 3 and 6 months, you figure out how to apply them and they come back and you can start performing again at that high level. And suddenly those strengths and all the tools you developed have reappeared magically and you're back to your old self. And it's a universal experience. And we try to tell our new hires that it's going to happen and it's totally okay. And to be kind to yourself and give yourself that time. And if it takes 3 months or it takes 6 months, that's fine. We're here to support you.
I think that's very true, especially in a distributed environment. You're not getting that same sort of first day, right, as you do in the office, because in the office, maybe on the first day you're coming in, you're sort of taking in a lot of what's around you. And that just as you're making those subconscious evaluations, you're also kind of absorbing subconscious learnings, perhaps at a faster rate on a lot of those intangible soft things. And so on your first day in an office, you might interact with 50 people, whereas on your first day virtually, you may interact with 5. And so by the end of the first week, that learning curve just looks a little different. And so, you know, based on a lot of what you've shared and reflected on, how have some of those learnings impacted the way that you think about onboarding your new hires, especially as a fully distributed company? Are there certain strategies or programs or resources that you provide to kind of help them get through that initial 3 and 6 month sort of window?
Yeah, one of the elements that we've run that I think is really important is kind of, there's a lot of research saying that highly impactful learning is socialized learning. And so onboarding people in peer groups, and Salesforce Sales Enablement did an amazing job in this. And I was lucky to be part of that project when I was there with Jess Maher and others leading the way. And they built peer groups of learners to go through an onboarding journey together. And the goal there was to be able to create customized journeys for more similar kinds of roles and to empower the teams to self-regulate, self-facilitate, as well as to share and support one another through the journey. And I think that's a really important thing. We've done that with distributed teams at Miro. So we've got people across the US, EMEA, and Russia, and we've mixed teams. So it's important from the first day that people get into mixed groups and they start learning from one another, and they start identifying, wow, Miro is really global. And how do people communicate? What are their realities and what are their roles? We don't want to create silos. And if you just leave people in distributed settings, silos are super easy to set up because there's not the natural water cooler talk. People don't see the mixed groups in the offices. So peer learning groups and having that socialized education from people across the organization can be done in a distributed way.
Yeah, I completely agree. I've used cohorts like that in past companies. And one of the things that I have found to be really valuable about that is even in your, you know, initial onboarding sessions, when you have sort of a diverse group of people that come from, you know, different backgrounds or have different skill sets, the questions that people ask are very different. And that in itself can really enhance your onboarding, because maybe you're in sales and you're hearing the types of questions that, you know, engineers are asking, or you're seeing the types of questions that folks on the marketing team are asking. And I think that can really help kind of round out your onboarding experience and push you to sort of think outside of your focus area. And then that in turn, as you have said, you know, it breaks down those silos that may otherwise develop over time, because from day one, like, you're already kind of thinking beyond the scope of your own role. So I really like that.
Totally.
Yeah.
Good.
The other thing is, you build a bond with your onboarding group. You know, if you do have extended time with them, they're the first people that you've really like gotten to know outside of those on your own team. And so I remember past companies, like, some of those onboarding groups would always have monthly lunches that would continue to go on for years while they were at the company because of the context in which they got to know each other initially. You're vulnerable together.
I think you've hit the nail on the head. And I think that's the toughest thing with distributed onboarding is, how do you build trust and vulnerability? And you've got to do a lot of heavy lifting to get that to happen. If you don't, I think the danger is, I bet we see a lot more employee churn. Because if you don't have trust, then people don't have, you lose some kind of stickiness and sense of community and identity. People want to be in community. Humans are social animals, and it doesn't happen naturally. If you put people in offices, there is a certain amount of community that will be built. Just distributed, it's not that different. And, you know, I've seen people posting on Twitter, you know, started a new job today. Here's my new laptop. Here's my old laptop. It was the fastest transition ever. And if it's just that, then you're going to lose people really quickly. And so you really got to get people to invest in each other. And I think those kind of socialized experiences, creating vulnerability, maybe bringing in some of those Brené Brown conversations, I think can be really, really well used in distributed settings.
Yeah, yeah. And it shows that you value it from the get-go. Like, if you're already talking about it in onboarding, it's clearly something that is really important to the culture. And I think, you know, one thing that I've been thinking about, which sort of branches off of this, is, especially at a distributed company, at any company, you can't expect anybody to know what your philosophy is on any given thing, or how you communicate around
how you communicate as an organization or what the speed of work looks like. Or, you know, you can't just assume that people know that coming in. And so being able to have forums where you talk through that stuff or have resources where that's documented, I think can be really helpful for, you know, both new hires as well as people who are at the company that have that to reference, having those strong philosophies that you've developed together.
I totally agree with you. And I think there's a truth that says like, hey, the key or the foundation of remote work is documentation. And I think that's totally true. You need great documentation. I think the danger with just following that line is it all becomes self-service and no one can read 1,000 Confluence pages and watch 20 videos. People together to talk about your values together rather than like read our values and watch the values module. Like the values module sucks. No one wants to watch the values module. But people together and talk about how what that value means, what resonates with them, what they don't understand, what it could look like. We did a kind of cool thing here where we got people to do a design thinking exercise where we trained them on some basics of design thinking. We told them about the values and we had them go out and interview existing employees and identify where are the gaps in the culture. And then do some prototyping for like what kind of solutions could be solved to make Miro even more aligned around the values, which gets them doing stuff with the content, which means they're actually learning it, gets them reaching out to other people across the company, and gets them to generate a bunch of cool ideas that we can use to make Miro better.
Yeah, I really like that approach because you're really getting your employees to critically think about these values rather than going through this memorization exercise almost of just kind of taking in what has been documented on a piece of paper. This is really going a step beyond that. You look at one company and, you know, you look at another company, a lot of our values are similar, right? We are customer first, we're innovation oriented. And so I think what is a lot more impactful is really understanding how those values show up in a given organization through the discussions that you have and through the enthusiasm in which people talk about them and the way you see them sort of show up. And so having forums to really explore that is, you know, a lot more valuable than just, as you've said, reading, you know, 20,000 Confluence articles on your first day. So yeah, one of the things you've talked about at Miro is this value of co-acting versus collaborating and how that's core to your culture. And so would love to hear a little bit more about that concept and how you ensure that that's part of the new hire and long-term Miro experience.
I think that it's kind of pointing towards, like I wrote a little article around this previously around the difference between co-acting and collaboration. Like, is it all the same? And I think my point is it's of coming together and breaking up tasks and doing them in isolation isn't really getting the real value from collaboration. What happens when two minds or more come together and you don't have just that one signal of we plan together, go away separately, come back together and critique. But look what's happening now. What if we riff off each other? What if we ideate together? What if we're both there doing design research, listening to a customer together and we debrief together? What if we retro together? And I think there's a huge amount of opportunity that happens when you can get people immersed together and really have that open collaboration. The value of Miro that is people's favorite is play as a team to win the world. And for us, that's all about this kind of collaboration, right? Not only that sense of celebrating together, but working together, learning together, reflecting together. And so how do you build that, right? And a lot of it is about building trust as a team. And if I say team building, it's not gonna be any surprise to anybody, but how many teams do that? How many teams invest in actually forming the team? Or if there's a new person who joins, reforming the team? How many really have real retros, but they don't just talk about what the work was, but how the team came together. And so we have a bunch of team agile practices that are about helping teams form those highly collaborative methods, not just divide and conquer or having different roles, but really co-working together. And we're really invested in this idea that if teams come together and truly collaborate, they can build incredible things using Miro, using these agile technologies, and with highly developed skills from onboarding, the rest of it, they can build amazing products and create huge value for customers.
Yeah, I think you hear a lot about Zoom fatigue, right? And I've thought a lot about this. And I think a key part of that is, you know, not as much the fact that you are on these video calls with other people, but it's more that these meetings have started to get really tactical and we're moving away from that collaborative aspect. And it is really more just like, okay, what are you doing? What am I doing? Are we on the same page? Like, okay, let's check these things off and just unblock for each other. It's a lot less of leveraging that forum for exactly what you have said, which is learning together, building that trust, reflecting, doing those retros, joining some types of meetings together to see, you know, what was your perspective on that versus mine. And so I think that's a really interesting concept that will be critical, especially as, you know, we continue working distributedly through this year, because it requires more intentionality, I think. than it does when we're together, because it's, you know, human nature to be inquisitive and curious and reflect and do all that off the cuff. But in your weekly stand-up, you definitely have to find ways to be purposeful around it.
Yeah. And I think it comes back to what you said beforehand around trust. Like, how can we build the trust needed to really collaborate in a synchronous way together? If you and I went into a room and got a whiteboard and just started drawing it, it would be much easier for us to be open, listen, comment, take on critiques, and really co-create something than if we're here, especially if we're just here with like Slack, like, or Google Doc. And that's kind of where whiteboarding or other kind of methods can really simulate. It's more of an immersive experience because we have a surface now that we're playing on. And I see your cursor running around and I can add on your sticky notes with my sticky notes. And so we've got to trick our minds into pretending we're proximal, we're near each other, because being close creates trust in that primitive part of our brain.
Right. And everyone learns differently, right? Like, some people are auditory learners. Some people are, like they say, like, and you come from the L&D space, so you know this more than me. But some people are kinesthetic learners. I remember I had someone on my team and we'd set meetings and she was always the first one on the whiteboard. Like, we'd have to whiteboard. And that was how she, you know, liked to think and liked to show her thinking. And it was always really fun. And so I made sure whenever we had meetings, we'd have an agenda and we'd have materials ahead of time for those that like to, you know, do their thinking ahead of time and those that like to know how we were covering the time. But not having it overly structured, because some people really like that open innovation brainstorming time. And you need to kind of set the space for that because everybody thinks and learns differently.
Yeah. How can we include and capture all the different perspectives we have, right? And that's where those kind of that ideation phase and having a surface we can all contribute to, we can hear more voices, we can see more perspectives. And that has to be some part of the problem solving process. It does, maybe multiple parts of the problem solving process. But if there's one document or one person writing, there's one person that's control and there's going to be one perspective. So I think there's a lot of awesome ways to bring in a couple of people's ideas. Or you look at what's happening with large scale meeting facilitation. You can get hundreds of people to share ideas and then vote on those ideas and have them even automatically synthesized. Like, we're getting towards some cool places where we can learn from a huge number of minds rather than listen to PowerPoint being read out.
Oh, yeah. I think when a lot of companies, right, kind of flip of a light switch went virtual and there was a lot of, wow, there are all these limitations around how we're working. And I think now that has shifted into look at all of these incredible opportunities in that collaboration space and capturing a lot of voices in the talent that we can bring into our organization and the diverse perspectives that that brings. So I really like the shift that's happening now. You talk a lot about, you know, trust and psych safety. And I think, you know, a number of the strategies that you have shared probably lead to trust, especially in, you know, constructive feedback that's exchanged from, you know, employees to their broader teams. And I'm curious, are there other strategies that you've used when you're coaching your managers around how to give and receive feedback, especially constructive feedback, in a way that builds on that psychological trust and safety, especially in a distributed environment? Because I know that can be hard and it can feel unnatural and different. And so how have you enabled your managers around that?
I think one of the questions for understanding why feedback doesn't work. And it's because we're kind of anchored to perceive whatever the person's saying, what we're going to interpret is they're saying they don't like me and they think I've done bad things and I'm failing, right? And so you've got to try really hard to not have that be the takeaway. That's the one, is you've got all these tripwires of having people having that kind of negativity bias where they're going to not look at the positive things. They're only going to focus on the negative things. And so how do you get over those hurdles and reach your goal? Because your goal is to give them actionable signal, to have them think about, hey, there's a new way of doing things in the future that I can undertake. And so I think to do that, there's kind of two major lenses I think is important. One is strength-based stuff. So everyone says they love critical feedback. No one loves 100% critical feedback. No one likes 50%. People like right. Or something.
It's overwhelming. It's hard to act on that volume of feedback, right?
It is. It also you just interpret it as this person hates me and thinks I'm bad and I should be ashamed really quick. You just get triggered. And so how do you use strength-based feedback but still be actionable? So the way to do that is by giving people, well, firstly, explicitly calling people's strengths. People ignore it unless you say, how can you further apply those strengths in the future? So we do in our models, we say, hey, here's your strength and here's how you could use it further. And here's the impact if you did. You have to motivate people to watch the strength stuff. And then on the constructive feedback, you have to justify, make them not interpret that you hate them. To say, here's the development gap. here's the impact of that. Here's why I'm telling you. It's not just because I don't like you. In fact, I do like you. And here's what you could do about it. And here's the wonderful rosy world that could happen. So here's the beautiful path forward. And that's a lot of heavy lifting. And that's just for two pieces of signal. So people don't put enough effort in jumping over the tripwires to make people feel like they can listen to the feedback and making it actionable, because people won't do the heavy lifting themselves of thinking about, what can I do with this feedback? You've got to really point it out to them. And the second, besides strength-based actionable feedback, I think is the Brené Brown stuff on clear is kind. Like having an attitude as someone who's writing feedback, being like, the right thing for me to do, the kind thing for me to do is to say the feedback, is to give this person a signal. The easy thing for me to do is to just give them some praise or be very general, right? Or not do the heavy lifting I just described in making it actionable and giving real signal. So I think knowing that the ethical thing, the kind thing, is actually to give the signal and doing the hard work, because you're going to tell yourself that, no, I don't want to cause issues. And that's not the right thing.
Right. Even on the positive side, I think when you're not clear and somebody, you know, does a good job and you're like, hey, great job on that presentation, like, how are they actually going to use that without even more specificity there, right? You're not even, I think even there, you're losing an opportunity to set them up for success the next time. And so I think that clarity is really important. I think you want to cultivate that growth mindset. And I think part of that is, you know, any sort of hurdle, you want that person to see it as an opportunity. And it's a lot harder to see the opportunity when there isn't a clear path forward or a clear sort of learning or takeaway from it. And I think you could cultivate more of that culture by, you know, being, like you said, a little bit more clear, a little bit more targeted, a little bit more supportive. And so I really like that. I think another part of that is also focusing on less feedback around maybe like the actual like product or the, you know, the tangible thing there and how they got there, so that people do continue to feel like they can take risks and try new things without fear of failure. And you're kind of guiding them along the way.
A really simple framework to help managers think about this, about having them give feedback on the what and the how. You know, the what was delivered against expectations or for the role or for products or for someone of that grade. And then how. How did they act in line with values or behaviors or management expectations? And then making sure they're giving both of those things. Otherwise, it sounds really simple. Otherwise, people can collapse them all the time. Or they think, well, that stuff was good, and so we won't really worry about the how stuff. And you can easily get a matrix and think about, hey, so people who are strong in what and weak in how and vice versa, and the different kind of coaching they need. And I totally agree. Most people do give strength-based feedback that's praise. And so be careful of just saying a nice thing. Development feedback will be interpreted as actionable. Like if I say, hey, that presentation wasn't organized, you'll infer an action of like, I need to make it more organized. If I say that the presentation was super organized, you're not going to think of making it more organized, even if you could, it'll make it. You got to do the heavy lifting there.
Yeah. And bringing this back to what you were saying earlier from, you know, your process as you join a new company over 3 months, you're constantly evaluating the bar, right? Like, what does organized look like here? What does fast look like here? What does strong communication look like here? And I think that really specific feedback enables you as a new hire also to understand what that culture looks like at your organization more quickly. So, and then, you know, another point that you talked about earlier is like this, you know, nobody wants 50% feedback. And I think it comes back to those ratios as well. I've seen lots of different ratios thrown out, but really there is that happy medium of, I think I've seen like 5 to 1, but people can really easily act on strong, positive feedback. It's something easy to respond to and it can go a really long way. And so how do you have that balance so that, you know, somebody can work on something that is maybe an opportunity or gap for them and then continue to drive those behaviors that are serving them really well?
And you can make any feedback positive. Like if people are like, I don't know how to say this, or I'm scared to say this to my boss, you make anything really positive if you just describe it as, hey, the thing you're doing works in these scenarios, but if you could make it work in these and these and these scenarios, look at the wonderful rosy future it would be. Now, I've just put a massive gap, but I've described a great part that's working well now and all these great parts in the future can work well. And people go come back and say, hang on, I thought you said clear is kind. I'm giving a clear signal of what the change should be. That's kindness. I'm pointing out a gap. I'm giving a clear signal. That person's going to go away and think clearly about this development area, right? And how they can tackle it. That's the kindness. The clear is kind isn't saying openly whatever you think. That's just being a bit lazy.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a great point. It shows that you understand the complexity as well. So yeah. So how do you enable your team to build strong relationships digitally? I know we've talked a lot about collaboration and how you've approached that, but when it comes to the relationship building side. I think the reality is that speaking to, you know, your team or, you know, another employee over Zoom or Hangouts or whatever it is that you use will not be the same experience as having those conversations in person. And perhaps, you know, you might not cross paths with someone that you don't work with by bumping into them in the kitchen while you're grabbing coffee. And so I guess my question is, do you think that fully distributed teams are able to achieve the same level of depth in the relationships that are formed? And, you know, if so, how should one think about supporting the team and being able to get there?
I think fully distributed teams can develop very strong relationships. I think they're much slower to develop than in-person teams. Again, it's that like immersion aspect. We don't really fool ourselves that you and I are in the same room right now, right? So we're building trust, but even if we're in the same room right now, we would be building trust faster. There's ways we can accelerate that, but compared to how fast they're going to be live, it's going to be different, which just means you've got to put in more work to do it. So we've got a cool group of people started this board game on top of Miro, where they built a card board game called Cozy Juicy Real. And basically, it's a way of getting teams to come together and they get to pick cozy questions, juicy questions, or real questions, different levels of depth of how open they're going to be about sharing about themselves. And I played this a bunch of times over the last year with different people on my exec team, on my own team, people across the company. I think we're playing it next week with new hires. And it's just a great way for people to have a bit more of a scaffold to share about themselves. In a way, it might bubble up if I said, hey, let's go for a coffee and talk about yourselves. And we walk around the block and I ask you some deep questions, right? That walk isn't going to happen anymore. So we need a bit more of extra work, extra scaffolding to open up those kind of conversations. And then I think you can get those teams to a really strong level of trust and a strong level of shared identity.
Yeah, I mean, it really comes down to FaceTime, right? And I love what you're doing because generally in an office, you're probably sitting next to your manager, you're seeing them for, you know, maybe 6-8 hours a day. Whereas now you're only seeing your manager face to face, maybe a few hours a week even. And so I think it is a lot harder to get to some of that more deep cutting stuff. And so I think, you know, going beyond the traditional sort of Zoom happy hour where it's surface level and using you know, your own technology to really cut to some of those more heartfelt questions that are getting at the core of, you know, people's identity and their experience. I think that intentionality and creating that forum is a great way to support people in getting to that place where they're able to build some of those deeper relationships more quickly. So great idea. So what do you think is the future of remote work at this point? I'm seeing a lot of companies thinking about, you know, as soon as the pandemic had passed, we're going straight back to in-person, nothing's changing. Some are on the other end saying we're going fully virtual forever. And, you know, what I think is interesting is this is a time where every industry has been faced with this transition and, you know, are embracing digital first this year. And so I guess, what is your thought on this? What do you think the future will look like? And what do we need to be thinking about as people leaders in alignment with that prediction?
Yeah, I was luckily able to write an article with some people at Miro for Fast Company on just this question, basically going through what are the different models from globally remote companies like GitLab, where you can literally work in 90 countries around the world, to companies that are going to go back to everyone is in the same office, even the same floor, and everything in between. And my kind of big takeaway for this is there's pros and cons for each of them. There's not a slam dunk. I think a lot of people are advocating everyone's going to be remote first. Not everyone's going to be remote first, 100%. Like read between the lines of what actual executives are saying, it's not happening. And not everyone's going back to offices either. And so people have to figure out for their business, for the current distribution of their employees' interests, the speed of collaboration they need, the nature of work they need, how cost-effective they need to be, you'll have different options you want to optimize for. So we've seen a bunch of companies say they're going to be remote first. What they mean by that is, hey, you've got to work in this time zone, or you've got to work in a place that can sometimes come to this shared co-working space. And that's going to be an interesting new model. The upside there is obviously recruiting and giving a lot of employees want to work from home. Or one of the downside is going to be, can they work? Can they create as fast collaboration? Can they build trust as quickly? Can they retain people in a sense of community for a long period of time? And then you've got a spectrum up to hybrid models where people are going to say, hey, if you want to be at office, come in office. If you want to go remote, go remote. That's great because everyone gets what they want. It's like, it's a choose your own adventure. The downside is it's really, really hard to create a quality remote experience and a quality in-person experience. You're going to probably leave out one of those groups, especially if you have kind of an implicit idea that leads or executives are all going to be in offices. Then you get this political dynamic where to move forward, you've got to be in the offices and people don't get heard for ideas outside and remote, and then they churn. And then you go up to people who are largely in office with some exceptions. And there the challenge is, well, you've kind of lost a bit of your ability to fire anywhere. And you've got to really invest in building offices that people want to be part of. So people are only going to go back to offices happily if they're going back to real communities. They're going back to real collaborative spaces. They're not going to go back to cubicles alone. And I think that's a big challenge for companies to think it's not just turning on the lights again. It's reinvesting and restructuring what collaboration really looks like. And it's not throwing away Slack and Zoom and Miro. Those tools will be seamlessly interweaved. It's also not going to be 5 days a week, I guarantee you. It's going to be 3 days in these hubs. Then you also get the last thing, you've got a little tension there between how can those people be remote and not my team? And then you've got the tough choice of splitting teams, which I think is a terrible idea. Because if you can in office, have that whole team in office and then having a remote team. So that's one way to skin the cat there. But still, there's going to be a tension and you're likely to forget the remote workers, which is what happened all until the pandemic. And then you've got the GitLabs and the Elastic stuff who are like work anywhere. And that's a very interesting idea that you could hire people who live in remote Swiss villages or in rural parts of Arizona, which is an amazing benefit. The challenge there is just like the speed. Like I wrote this on LinkedIn yesterday. The world is high ping. Like the world has got high latency that if I'm working with someone who's 12 hours away and they're responding to what I write at the end of my day, and then writing back the next day, that's really slow, where you and I have had 1,000 interactions so far in this conversation. And so it's very easy to fit into coacting, not collaborating. Now, smart people can work on that in different ways, and some work is great to do serially rather than in parallel, but it's still a really big challenge for companies that have to develop products really quickly.
Yeah, I think that's a super thorough analysis. And I think what you're getting at in some ways is companies will need to have an intentionality around it. Just like we intentionally share, these are our core values and this is how psych safety shows up. I think the, you know, do whatever you want, sure, work from home, come in, whatever. I think there should be a little bit of intentionality around it so that we don't end up with ghost offices where maybe there is an office, but everyone's not really thinking about it in the exact same way, or half the team is coming in and half the team isn't. And that isn't maybe intentional, or they're not supported in the way that they need to be. I think the beauty around that intentionality is just as you attract people that share your value set, you're also, you know, when you're openly sharing that, you're attracting people that are excited about working that way. The reality is some people love remote work and they are really successful. Some people, it's not for them. And so when you're open about that, then they're not signing up for a work experience that isn't what they're looking for. So I think that'll be huge.
Totally agree with you. And there are costs in every path. And so if you're not open-eyed, I love the idea of intentionality, like pick your lane and like figure out how to get the benefits from it and invest in resources in that and figure out what the costs are. Make sure you're okay with it. Try to minimize them, but own it from the beginning because it's going to happen. And if you're not there, they're going to be bigger.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Well, I will wrap with one last question. I know, you know, you've been in the learning and development space for a large chunk of your career. And so I'm curious, you brought up Brené Brown earlier. Are there other sort of places you go or books you've read or, you know, frameworks, anything that you found really helpful over your sort of people and talent career?
Yeah.
That you'd like to share?
Two books that I love. Well, first, there's so many books that I think are not super useful. So like my first piece of advice is be cautious how you invest your learning time. But two that I can guarantee are full of real practical learning. One is The Hard Thing About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz. That is something that's kind of universally acclaimed, but for great reason. For anyone who's joining a startup, especially on the people side, especially any senior kind of role, just full of really practical advice for making tough decisions. And the core idea there is like, hey, are you creating management debt in this action? Hey, if we just let everyone choose, anyone can pick if they want to be remote or come into the office, just do it. Great. We're making people happy now, but we're creating this massive, massive, massive management debt for the next couple of years. So that's a great one. And the second one that I love for, I don't know, 15 years now is The Fifth Discipline by Peter Senge. He's an MIT professor. This came out in the early 90s, but his big insight is like systems thinking. You've got to help people see the system they're operating in. If people only see the tasks they do, then they're going to make all these kind of mistakes. Mistakes like not prioritizing effectively, mistakes like not seeing how their actions impacting the system, mistakes like thinking that the other team or the other function are the enemy over there who are just doing the wrong thing and their team is the good team, all those kind of crazinesses and those pathologies it can create. So Fifth Discipline is a great text that unpacks what kind of learning looks like in an organization, at a team level, an individual level, and in this organizational knowledge sharing space. And that's been really important for me as I think about creating and growing organization.
Yeah, those are good recommendations. I actually just downloaded The Hard Thing About Hard Things on my Audible queue a couple days ago. So I'm glad to hear that endorsement. I'll check out the other one as well. Yeah, for sure. Great. Well, AJ, I really appreciate you taking time to come on the show and for sharing your story and everything you've learned through your journey. As someone who is, you know, now leading the people team at a fully distributed company, I think it's always really helpful when other companies or people that have done this for a while step up and share their learnings and resources. So you as head of people at Miro and, you know, Miro as a company have been fantastic around doing that. So super appreciate you and your team.
Rosica, thank you so much. It was wonderful to come discuss with you and to reflect on this crazy year of 2020 and the organization I'm lucky enough to work with. So thank you so much for the conversation.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast and want to hear more stories like this, please subscribe for the weekly drop and feel free to share around with your people and talent colleagues. I'd love your feedback, so please leave a review and let us know what you enjoyed and what types of topics you'd like to see covered in the future. The more reviews and subscribers we get, the more quality content we can consistently deliver to you. If you're interested in being on the podcast, feel free to reach out to me at rusica@engageandempower.org. See you next week.